successful in helping KBOO raise money. If you are interested, please call KBOO at 503-231-8032 extension 207 or email us at membership@kboo.org. Thanks, and I look forward to hearing from you soon.
Ago, four lads from Liverpool invaded America.
You say you will love me if I have to go. You'll be thinking of me. Somehow I will know.
Join KBOO February 7th from noon to 4 as we pay tribute to John, Paul, George, and Ringo.
We remember, we listen, we learn from those who have walked before us, from those who can teach us now.
Since 1993, Native American community, through cultural programs, including the Northwest Indian Storytelling Festival, a collection of video oral histories of Native elders, and the Wisdom Radio series on Thursday evenings for several months now. On Friday, February 14th, folk singer Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul, and Mary will be performing in Portland at a benefit concert for the organization here. Join us this Thursday, February 6th, for a special two-hour edition of Wisdom of the Elders, with Daniel Dixon talking about the history and work of Wisdom of the Elder Yarrow, Aaron Nigel Smith, and the One World Chorus, right here on KBOO, your cultural connection.
In part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
Welcome to the third partnership show of Oregon Community Media, working in collaboration to better serve Oregon. Oregon Community Media is composed of over 20 local and independent community broadcasters. All share a commitment to community service and to keeping local voices alive on the radio dial. This time around, you'll hear about rural healthcare. Participating this time are KWSO Warm Springs, KSKQ Ashland, and KPOV Bend. I'm Erin Yankee from KBOO Portland. Stay tuned. Rural healthcare is an issue in a large geographic portion of Oregon. Access to care is an issue, with vast distances in some instances between where a patient lives and where a provider is available. Sue Matters reports on the efforts of Oregon Health Sciences University to better understand rural healthcare needs.
Oregon Health Sciences University, or OHSU, is Oregon's only comprehensive academic medical center. They consider Oregon as their 96,000-square-mile campus. To better determine the best way to educate and train doctors and other medical providers to meet the needs for rural health care in Oregon, a team from OHSU visited rural areas last summer. Amongst their stops was the Warm Springs Reservation and included time at the Indian Health Services Clinic. George Mexicano is the Senior Associate Dean for Education in the School of Medicine at OHSU. He says healthcare and education and society are changing rapidly, and that changes need to be made now in anticipating the change of future needs.
I'll give you two lessons, if you will, that we've learned on our trip. The first is the innovation and passion that occur in healthcare settings such as Warm Springs. We've talked about teamsmanship and the patient-centered medical home, and it's here. It's alive and well. So that's one big lesson that we've learned. I think the second big lesson that we've learned has to do with and it's a double-edged sword. It's both the realization that the current system doesn't work, we need to change, but also concern that we make sure that we meet the needs, right? I think we heard that a little bit today, right? So we're not, we need to solve a whole bunch of problems, that, and education is one means to do that. And yet, we don't want to go make such a radical leap or such a drastic change, we make some decisions that have adverse effects for the communities. And so that's a delicate walk to walk. And simultaneously, the communities and we believe the people, society, are both ready for change but concerned about change. And that's a big lesson that we've learned.
He also explains his position at OHSU and their visits throughout rural Oregon communities.
I am the Senior Associate Dean for Education in the School of Medicine at Oregon Health and Sciences University. My portfolio includes not only the medical school program, but also the residencies and fellowships at OHSU, and also continuing education and the graduate program. So essentially all of the educational pieces of the School of Medicine. We are really on a listening tour because we want to try to understand the needs of communities across Oregon and the region so that we can better design programs that will eventually produce the healthcare professionals of tomorrow. And we know we can't do that in a vacuum. We have to listen and we have to respect and we have to honor the skill and the local circumstances of each of these communities. It's not a one-size-fits-all process. And so as we think about how we're going to change and expand, we need that input, that vital input from all different voices across Oregon and the region.
Dr. Mark Richardson is the OHSU School of Medicine Dean. He visited rural Oregon, including Warm Springs, last summer. He talks about some of the unique healthcare access issues in rural Oregon and some uses of technology to try and bridge those gaps.
You know, the relative distances and transportation access needs, I think one of the really interesting new developments is our use of telemedicine, and that, of course, is just using information technology to connect providers here in Portland with patients throughout Oregon through sort of face-to-face connections over the computer. We can do that and, again, partner with local providers, but it's a really innovative way of delivering care, education, in a way that would hopefully provide less need for travel in the long run. And the other part of that, I think, too, is how can we help actually elevate the skill levels of the providers, or how can we create more providers at the local level with greater capability? And there's some great models around some things that have happened within the Native American Health Service in Alaska there that I think have shown that you can actually help the county nurses or other providers improve their skills to provide safer, more effective care locally rather than relying on, you know, sending people off or getting care from specialty centers.
OHSU has worked with tribes and Indian Health Service units and looks to maintain current partnerships and looks toward other possible ways to collaborate to meet healthcare needs in rural Oregon.
Or have been asked to participate and partner with several of the tribes with our diabetes center, looking at diabetes prevention, education, technical assistance, and public service campaigns. So I think that's a potential area of partnership. And, of course, our Knight Cancer Institute is very interested in cancer prevention with the School of Public and Preventative Health. So I think those are two really good areas that we could look at. Again, access to mental health services, especially in Eastern Oregon, is very difficult. And I think a telehealth approach to that may be of value. I think the last time I checked, there was one psychiatrist in Bend. That was it for Eastern Oregon. Now, there are lots of other mental health care providers, you know, psychologists and so forth. But, you know, there's clearly poor access to mental health services. And trying to figure out ways to improve that, I think, would be a benefit.
Oregon Health Science University, working toward training medical providers for the 21st century with a special interest in how best to meet the needs of citizens who live in rural Oregon. I'm Sue Matters in Warm Springs, reporting for Oregon Community Media.
You are listening to Oregon Community Media, a collaboration of community stations across Oregon. This episode is about rural healthcare. Next up, we'll hear an interview from KSKQ in Ashland, Oregon. The Brain Labor Report is a weekly news and interview program focusing on issues of the working class. The topic of this discussion is delivery of rural healthcare and the accompanying challenges. Also discussed is a description of single-payer healthcare in Oregon. Their mission is to bring equitable healthcare for the whole community. The host, Wes Brain, is an organizer with Healthcare for All Oregon. His guests are Mike Kellenbach from the Main Street Alliance, a coalition of small business leaders in Oregon, and Rich Road, an organizer with Oregon Action. We start with Mark and an overview of our healthcare challenges. We'll then hear from Rich, who explains the work of community care organizations and the way they are delivering healthcare for rural Oregon. They'll discuss some of the unique opportunities for jobs and economic development in rural communities.
Folks, you're listening to the Brain Labor Report this morning on KSKQ, 89.5 FM. This is your community radio station. Great conversation. We're talking about health care and, in fact, rural health care. Here in the studio, I wanted to introduce them right now. We have Mark Kellenbeck and Rich Rohde. Mark Kellenbeck is chair of Healthcare for All Oregon Rogue Valley and a leader, co-founded the Oregon chapter of the Main Street Alliance. Rich Rohde is here. By gosh, we celebrated with Oregon Action the other day. 30 years of activism, retired just now recently with Oregon Action. Welcome, Rich and Mark. Mark, to get us started, just kind of an overview on, I mean, healthcare is not working too well. Can you give us kind of the big picture, and then we'll talk more about rural healthcare also, please.
So the challenge in the U.S., certainly the case in Oregon, and certainly the case for rural Oregon, has been escalating costs. The cost of health care has been rising at a rate around 8.5% compounded, whereas the rest of the economy, certainly during the recession, but even looking over the last 20 years, is growing more like a 2.5% if it's doing well. So that escalation over time has made healthcare, the cost of providing care for ourselves or employees, just unaffordable. So we've reached a crisis point and actually beyond where it's really, really difficult to provide the kind of benefits and coverage, particularly through health insurance, that we once did and what we'd like to do now. So if it's not a crisis now, and most of us would agree that it is, certainly in a few years, 2025 is not that far away, 11 years, the average family would spend 100% of their income on health care.
You know, it is a crisis for many people today who, you know, maybe they get in a car wreck, a catastrophe, they're diagnosed with cancer, and all of a sudden they maybe don't have access, and they sure don't have the money in their pocket to pay for the huge costs out there. Rich, I want to ask you about, you've been working on the delivery end, pretty good excitement in Oregon with what they call CCOs. Tell us about that a little bit, could you?
Sure. CCO is Coordinated Care Organization. It's part of the transformation process that Oregon is doing to really make sure that the delivery of health care makes people healthier, make sure that we're getting a better patient experience, and it's lowering the costs. So those are some of the goals. The notion of coordinated care organizations are that in each community, there's going to be a local organization that's going to have a global budget making decisions about how we deliver health care. And they're going to coordinate not only your medical home, your family doctor, your doctor experience, but also dental care, mental health, and substance abuse all into one coordinated delivery system so that we can really make sure that people get the care that they need and that they lower the cost. And here's the secret of this is that it's decentralized. It's not controlled by somebody far off, but people in the community. So I serve on two CCO advisory committees that really are digging in. They're just ordinary people, people coming together from all backgrounds. 50% of those are going to be clients of the coordinated care organizations. So let me just say that who's in that coordinated care organization are right now is people on the Oregon Health Plan. And since we've opened that up, that's going to include a lot of people. We heard from Ellen Penny this weekend that now 50% of the people in Oregon are now on a public plan. And that means that they're like a single payer. But we need to make sure that those folks are getting the best care that they can get, that they have access to doctors, they have access to dental care. That's what the CCO movement is.
Rich, what you're saying sounds like if we could have somebody coordinating this thing, wouldn't it be more efficient? I tell you, how many hours do people spend filling out the same form over and over and over? Okay. Thank you. That drives me crazy. Here in rural Oregon, how about this idea? I've seen the feds sometimes think Medford is rural. And if you live in Medford, you'd kind of laugh at that. But if you look at the big map, most of Oregon is rural. I mean, what, almost half of our population, Rich, lives right up there in three counties in and around Portland, Oregon. And if you live in Lakeview and you get in a wreck, the response time for the emergency vehicles is not going to be like it's going to be if you wreck on the bridge in Portland. It just isn't. But that's just emergencies. What about the challenges in rural Oregon? They don't have the doctors we need, Rich. What about that? Any ideas?
Well, it's a big challenge. And certainly, small rural hospitals are really under challenges how they can survive these days. The question about do we have enough practitioners in rural areas? One of the things that the CCOs are doing are they're coming up with a whole new category of workers. You can think of them as kind of community healthcare workers that are going to be able to reach out, not just from hospitals, but go out into the community. So I think in rural areas, I think that's going to be one of the places that this new form of delivery is going to be helpful. But clearly, we also have to make sure that we're addressing the need for practitioners of all across all areas. And so that's going to be a challenge, but we have in place now the kind of the democratic participation of people that can raise that issue and then say, let's go after solutions.
We need more doctors where we need them, when we need them. Just let's talk about the demographics of Oregon for just a minute. And mentioned earlier, this is pretty close to true. It's actually a little under half, but not too far under half of the population of the state of Oregon is in three counties. You know what they are? They're Clackamas, Multnomah, and what's that other one? Washington County, up there around the metropolitan area of Oregon. And then, folks, most people who come to Oregon, they think that we're Interstate 5. That's all they ever see. They drive, if you're driving north, you go through Ashland, Medford, the Rogue Valley. You might see Grants Pass. If it's not real foggy, you'll go to Eugene, Salem, Portland. Now you've seen Oregon. That's it. Guess what? Rich, you know about this. Over two-thirds of Oregon's a desert, and it's east of the Cascades, isn't it?
Well, one simple way to think about it is three-quarters of the land of Oregon is the second district, and that has one-fifth of the voting population in our state. And they are hit harder economically right now, but that's been a history of economic struggle, but they're a critical part of our state. And so how we integrate them politically and medically is extremely important. And I don't know that we have all the answers, but this is a key to me.
Sure.
Is that we do it democratically. If we make sure that people's voices are heard at every stage, at every place, in the legislature, in their local communities, and with their medical system, we will find the solutions that get there. That's the part when you have private health insurance, you don't have a voice.
Rich, here's what I was thinking, and Mark, you jump in too if you'd like with our conversation. You know, they don't have sometimes the doctors. When the insurance, here's the problem with the insurance companies, okay? They dictate which doctor you can see based on the plan that they've developed. They develop their plans by contracting with certain groups of doctors. Now, if your doctor's in, you're in good shape. If your doctor's not, you got a big problem. Now, here's what else happens. If your doctor refers you to somebody else, now, if that somebody else is in, you're in good shape. But that somebody else is not in that insurance company's plan, then, in fact, the insurance company gets in the way between you and your doc. That's one challenge that I really find with the insurance companies running things, is that, in fact, it isn't up to your doctor the care you get. It's up to the insurance company who they have a financial contractual agreement with. What about that?
It's definitely a challenging situation, far less than ideal, certainly from our standpoint as clients or patients, for sure. The solution may well be in the coordinated care organizations, which I think will be far more inclusive with their services. Ultimately, looking forward, perhaps beyond the insurance situation we have today, so even beyond what we have with Cover Oregon, the Affordable Care Act, etc., would be a solution such as single payer. But single payer is going to be multifaceted in its approach. So one of the key ingredients, obviously, is how this is all paid for in the most cost-effective, efficient method, lowering the cost of overhead. There's been a lot of discussion about that. Obviously, insurance companies would be caught in a bind there.
So when you say single payer, you are talking about the paying end of it, whereas when we're talking with Rich about CCOs, we're talking about the delivery of a system. Say a little more about that single payer paying for it end of it, could you, Mark?
Sure. So again, the point is it's not just how we pay for it, but that's going to be a critical component for the solution, a better system than we currently have. So single payer proposes much as what we have with Medicare today, actually also much of what we have with VA and other programs, which are unified. So rather than several thousand insurance companies, you have one point of payment. They have one agreement, one would hope with all doctors. Almost all doctors participate with Medicare or Medicaid. It's much greater coverage for sure. So the benefit of that is that program has huge efficiencies. So it's much, much less.
Who would be in it?
Well, single payer.
Everybody,
would be,
huh?
Everybody, yeah. That's the proposal. How you would bring in the VA and, you know, Medicare, et cetera, will be an interesting challenge. But the ideal situation, everybody in and nobody out, is the classic statement. And it would be, you know, a birth to death, the time we exit type coverage. Very much prevention driven, very much open to, I guess, new ways and different ways of delivering service at the lowest cost. So the idea of CCOs being very close to service, the idea of providing innovative coverage, new ideas that are proving, you know, great results, this would be part of the new single-payer system.
Can we talk more about the good news of single-payer? How, if we didn't have any insurance companies involved, it might be a different world. It'd be more efficient, for sure. What do you think, Mark?
Yes, from a business perspective, so speaking as a small businessman and also for Main Street Alliance, which is now 1,700 plus small businesses throughout Oregon, and per our last survey, there's tremendous interest in an alternative system, something that's more efficient, in some ways more humane, in that it provides service for everyone regardless of their status. Most of us would say regardless of even whether they're a U.S. citizen, so we're looking to provide truly universal coverage. The interesting thing, we discussed it the other night, it's a primary topic relative to universal health care and its cost, is we are already in the U.S. paying twice what the rest of the world is paying for health coverage, but not coverage. Yeah, so it's amazing. So our system is terribly fractured, terribly inefficient. So raising the dollars we're already doing, perhaps we even will save money and won't 10 years from now or 20 years from now be twice the rest of the world with poorer outcomes and not covering all of our citizens. So actually the dollars are there clearly. The need for health care is there clearly. It's probably rising. It's just a question of putting it into the most efficient and most humane. By that I mean truly covering everyone for everything. So a true universal health care system, there would be no co-pays, no deductible, no out-of-pocket expenses. You simply show up, let's say at your local clinic. I think you'll see a movement more towards that. And you go in and you get your services. And you'll do that from the time literally you're born or conceived, right on through the final care, the final days of your life. It's just a far, far more efficient system. Obviously, the world's showing us it's much less costly. But I think most significantly, at least to myself and lots of small business people, it's the most caring and humane thing as well.
Healthcare for All Oregon is the name of that campaign in this state, seeking to do the same thing that was done in Vermont. By the way, they did it this way in Canada, one province at a time. Vermont's leading the way in the United States of America, and Oregon's not far behind. Great group of folks. Consider going to www.hcao.org. That's the website for Healthcare for All Oregon. Rich, I want to ask you about something. You got me excited about something I heard you talking about a while ago, because it implied jobs. You understand the vision for changing healthcare in this country. I want listeners to understand this, is a change of jobs. There are many who are predicting that with a system like you're talking about, Mark, a single-payer healthcare system, everybody in, nobody out, that in fact there will be a tremendous change in the kinds of healthcare jobs that there are. People will be working much more with prevention care. And Rich, you got me excited about this because you were mentioning about people who are in the community doing maybe some of these new jobs. I think that's the tip of the iceberg for possibly a new sector in healthcare that could expand.
Well, you know, right here in Jackson County, Rogue Community College is just opening up a new course that's available for people to train in these new community health worker jobs. And it's a pilot. I mean, it was actually, there was a pilot project that went on earlier to kind of see if they took, I think, maybe as many as 20 people and gave them the training and then put them out in the community working in many in rural places, Butte Falls and for, you know, out in that area.
Tremendous.
And, yeah. And so what we're going to have is a new way of connecting people to their healthcare system besides just episodically walking into a hospital emergency room or a doctor's office. We're going to make sure that people, particularly with chronic conditions that need constant care, are going to have somebody that's able to help them navigate that, get into the system. And those new jobs, I hope, are going to be, we need to make sure that they're paid well. But, you know, I think that it opens up a new place for people. And if they follow the philosophy that these should be collaborative jobs, people are going to work in teams. They're going to be able to look at the whole picture. And I would hope that that means that people, when they start these community jobs, are going to find a community ladder. They're going to find a way to participate and grow in their careers. It is exciting, but it's just getting launched, and we'll see. One of our friends said, "Oh, I'm thinking of taking this course." And her question was, "Are there jobs at the end of that?" And you know what? I said, "I don't know, but boy, I sure hope there are." I mean, I think that they're doing this in coordination with the notion that the CCOs and the community organizations out there are going to say, "These are the people we need. We're going to put them to work."
Yeah, I'd like to echo what I heard in the sentiments of Rich, and that's to be looking forward in a positive manner, not to get sidetracked or lost in maybe politics, particularly the national politics around healthcare, and to really look for what's going to work, what's going to work for the average citizen, what's going to work for business, small business. And really, it's a collective. We're talking about a new way of doing something for ourselves that's highly cooperative and collaborative and benefiting the collective. That's all of us. When it comes to healthcare, a major expense, really this is the best, if not the only solution to do this together and to do it really, really well.
Mm-hmm.
This segment was recorded and edited at the studio of KSKQ. The Brain Labor Report can be heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. exclusively on KSKQ. You are listening to the third Oregon Community Media Collaborative show. This episode is about rural healthcare. Sue Matters from KWSO in Warm Springs delves deeper into the findings of Oregon's most recent health equity report. A report examining the outcome of programs run by the Oregon Health Authority and the Department of Human Services shows there's a lot of work to do to achieve health equity based on race and ethnicity. Jolene Estimo-Pitt explains.
The state would like to be responsive, and what they decided, working with a group of folks from the tribal communities across the state of Oregon, is that we thought that the storytelling would be a good way to get the community involved in talking about health. And the state and the tribes would like to use this, what they call strength-based approach. So what we would like to do before we start talking about, you know, some of the disparities and issues in health is that we want to first start with talking about what is health for us today. And once we can, you know, get that distinguished, then we can look at, we can start maybe talking about disparities from, you know, more of a strength-based place.
The goal is to learn more about how healthcare and social service programs can better serve the Warm Springs community, but also how individuals can find ways to be healthier. It may involve looking to the past. From the KWSO archives, here's an interview with Adeline Miller talking about her childhood.
But we stayed home with Grandma, and we enjoyed it. She was one old lady that really taught my sister and I a lot. Somebody'd come to the house, she'd say, "You get up and warm up coffee. Give them something to eat. Never leave anybody that's going to leave the house hungry. Always share something with your neighbor that comes." So, and I learned how, my sister learned how to cook. And her, I remember her biscuits being as hard as a rock. And my uncle would get it and powder on table that I mean on the floor. We ate on the floor. We didn't eat on the table. The floor was our table. People were like that in all their homes. They prefer eating on the floor. And he said, "Yay, this is good." He'd have to soak his bread in the coffee to eat it. So when it got around to me, "Now you cook something. You cook mush." I cooked a bowl of mush. Time to eat. He got that bowl, dumped all the mush into his bowl. Look, it's empty. So I had to get up and make another bowl. I didn't have to measure anything. I was just really giving it a try, though. But he wouldn't laugh at us. He'd compliment us for trying anyhow. And I guess that's why we continue to do until we finally did get to know how.
Thinking about healthy living, healthcare programs, social service programs, and thinking about how we can all do a better job with prevention and education. From the KWSO StoryCorps archives, here's an interview Liz Smith did with Elise Bagley. In this segment, they talk about planning for children.
It's kind of funny because my mom, she asked me if I wanted kids, and of course my grandma wants a lot of grandkids, and I'm like, I don't know, I've got a lot of brothers and sisters, and I watched my mom have my baby sister Marie, and that was something. I wasn't expecting to see that. I was about ready to leave the room, and the nurse shut the door and just closed the curtain, and she's like, "Can you sit down, please?" And I'm like, yeah.
You're stuck, huh?
Yeah. I'm sitting there, and I'm just peeking, and then you just see her, and then she's all, "Oh, Papa's coming." I'm like, "Oh, my gosh." I was looking out the window.
How old were you?
I was 14. I was like, "Oh, gosh." And my mom's all, she's like, you want to be a teen mom now? I was like, no, no.
Healthcare and social service access, and thinking about how we can all do a better job with prevention and education.
So I think that the local programs here are also trying to make these similar changes. Our local Joint Health Commission, they have also identified prevention as being a primary goal of theirs. So I think that this report is going to be able to help us locally in trying to address some of the health disparities within our community.
In Warm Springs, I'm Sue Matters reporting for Oregon Community Media. We'll now hear from KPOV in Bend. Barb and Judy report on disease prevention through diet and exercise.
This is Judy and Barb reporting for KPOV's All Things Vegan.
In 2010, President Bill Clinton, well known as a lover of fast food, made headlines by announcing that he had adopted a primarily plant-based diet on the advice of physicians treating his heart disease. Clinton underwent quadruple bypass surgery in 2004, but it was in 2010, after he had emergency surgery to insert a pair of stents after one of his veins had given out, that he dramatically changed his lifestyle. Since then, he's lost and kept off 30 pounds. He said that he wanted to live to be a grandfather, and he decided to choose the diet that he thought would maximize his chances of long-term survival, and that was a plant-based diet.
Along with President Clinton, millions of others are choosing this increasingly popular lifestyle choice, not only for improving their own health, but also for environmental concerns and ethical reasons involving the treatment of animals.
Over the last several years, more and more doctors have been speaking out about the benefits of a vegan lifestyle in preventing and sometimes reversing many of our major diseases. For this piece, we talk with a Central Oregon-based cardiologist.
We're here today with Dr. Rick Cook. He is a non-invasive cardiologist with an interest in prevention who works for Bend Memorial Clinic here in Bend. He's just contributed a chapter to Rethink Food, which is a comprehensive book on the merits of a plant-based diet that's going to be coming out later this year. So welcome, Rick.
Thanks for having me.
We wanted to talk to you a little bit today about some of the things that people can do for themselves to prevent the major diseases of Western society. What are your tips?
For one thing, you should never underestimate what the potential impact is of what we would classify as lifestyle modifications. So what does that come down to? That comes down to what people can do for themselves. It doesn't even require a physician, which would be things we do all the time or we should be doing all the time. For instance, diet. Food, it's said, could be a medicine if it's used properly. And like any medicines, if we use them properly, they can do good things. If we don't use them properly, they can do bad things. Diet is absolutely essential. More fresh fruits, more fresh vegetables. There is emerging compelling data that people should limit animal proteins, both for cardiovascular benefits, as well as now we're seeing that there are reports that decrease cancer incidence, up to 30% obese, to the point where in recently released guidelines from the American Heart Association, American College of Cardiology, obesity is now going to be considered a disease, a chronic disease, because of what obesity does. It leads to atherosclerosis or heart disease. It leads to diabetes. It leads to hypertension. And our kids are less active and they're getting bigger. That's one real cornerstone. The other thing that's most important is exercise. The current recommendations are for at least 30 minutes of continual exercise, and that includes things like walking, but continual, 30 minutes continually four times a week. There's some thought that that might even be changing to every day. The health benefits are just substantial, both physically, mentally, helping maintain lean body mass, helping maintain bone density, and boys walking. So there's going to be an increased amount of focus on that. And the more you do, the more benefit you get. You just have to make it part of your routine. Those are the two most important things that people could be doing for themselves every day. There are other things like don't smoke, moderate your alcohol intake, and things like that. But those are the two things I would start with.
So those two main things being limiting animal proteins and exercise?
I think they're proven benefits, and we're seeing it across multiple modalities or areas of medicine, whether it's brain health, preventing Alzheimer's disease, cancer reduction, cardiovascular disease reduction, which is the number one killer of men and women in this country, overwhelmingly. And it's estimated that up to 80% of those deaths could be prevented through appropriate lifestyle modification as well as Medicare.
If you have a patient who has severe heart disease and comes to you and is willing to do some of those lifestyle changes, such as a plant-based diet, what kind of results are you seeing?
So a number of studies have been done looking at plant-based diet versus vegetarian versus all-comers, omnivores, if you will, meat eaters. With heart disease, one of the very important things is in people with established heart disease, if you lower their bad cholesterol, the low-density lipids, or the LDL is what we call it, we lower the risk for heart attack and stroke, adverse cardiovascular events. So any way you can do that, traditionally, most people are on cholesterol-lowering medications for that, but any way you can do that results in improvement. So different diets have been heavily studied. Probably the Oxford study in England was one of the largest. There's been others in this country as well. But what they saw is that going to a plant-based diet, they saw reductions of the LDL cholesterol in the first 6 weeks, over 33% reduction. Right off the bat, no medication. The only medication you're modifying is your diet medication. And so there's substantial benefit in that. They also saw that both vegetarians and vegans compared to meat eaters had lower mortality rates over time. In studies that have been done, when they look at the amount or the plaque burden or the atherosclerotic burden inside the heart arteries, they actually saw that some of those cholesterol plaques that have not yet calcified actually regressed with plant-based diets. So that when they looked at them at day one and then 2 years later, they actually saw that heart disease was reversing itself. We tend to think sometimes that heart disease is not a reversible process, but in fact it is. That's very exciting. We just should never underestimate what we can do with lifestyle modification.
As these principles become more widely known, what do you see the impact on healthcare and medicine being?
Well, I think it's a necessity. If you look at the projections right now about, for instance, what cardiovascular disease is going to cost, you know, by 2030, we're going to bankrupt the system. We're not going to be able to afford to take care of ourselves. And you can cut all the fees you want, come see guys like me and things like that. We're simply not going to be able to afford to maintain a decent quality of life unless we change the epidemic, both of cardiovascular disease, but also just the obesity trends. I think it's out of necessity from that standpoint. There's going to be some other things coming down the pike that are going to be beneficial. I don't think we can underestimate what genomic medicine is going to look like for us. That might lead to discoveries that will probably more responsibly help people who are predisposed to things like obesity and through leptin genes and stuff like that to identify those individuals at risk and maybe even genetically help them and treat them with genes instead of medicines. Genetics are a powerful thing that we only are scratching the surface on what we understand. So that's actually coming along very quickly. So it might look very different 10 years from now to start taking better care of ourselves.
Are you going to work yourself out of a job?
That would be my goal. I would love to just be a preventive cardiologist. What we see frequently, at least in the American medical system, and we're going to have to change this approach as well, is that we do an excellent job of cleaning up the train wrecks once the train has crashed, as opposed to emphasizing keeping the train on the tracks. So it's the difference between treatment after a bad event versus prevention, and never letting that bad event happen to begin with. And part of that is it's human nature. Doing all the right things to avoid a bad thing, it doesn't motivate people sometimes as much as you're in a bad position and you got fixed, if that makes sense. It's kind of like the reward thing with things like gambling and why humans gamble and things like that. So it's a really philosophical change to say, hey, we're going to focus on prevention, and we have to.
Thank you, Dr. Cook.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is Barb and Judy, hosts of All Things Vegan.
From 88.9 KPOV Bend with Oregon Community Media.
Our final piece on the topic of rural health care will focus on the Affordable Health Care Act and Indian Health Service. Indian Health Service is an agency within the Department of Health and Human Services and is responsible for providing federal health services to American Indians and Alaska Natives. The provision of health services to members of federally recognized tribes was established in 1787 and is based on Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. The Indian Health Service is the principal federal health care provider and health advocate for Indian people, and its goal is to raise their health status to the highest possible level. Staffing of Indian Health Service is a mixture of civil service, federal employees, and United States Public Health Service Commission officers. On the Warm Springs Reservation, a recent effort of Indian Health Services and the tribe's Insurance and Health and Human Services branch has been to sign up tribal members under Cover Oregon for the Affordable Care Act. Sue Matters has more.
In the Affordable Care Act law, there's actually recognition that Native Americans and Alaska Natives are not mandated to sign up for insurance. However, in Warm Springs, those who only get their health care from Indian Health Service but have no other insurance are being encouraged to sign up. In doing so, they ensure coverage of their health care needs even away from the reservation's IHS clinic service area. And additional health insurance means the tribes can save money on health expenses as they're self-insured. Most of the 700-plus people who have recently sought health insurance have qualified for the expanded Medicaid program. Estimates are that there are about 1,300 more people who should get signed up. The Affordable Health Care Act is a good thing for Warm Springs. Mark Trahant is a member of the Shoshone-Bannock Tribe of Idaho and former president of the Native American Journalist Association. He is currently the chairman of the Atwood Journalism School at the University of Alaska, Anchorage. Recently, he produced a series on the Affordable Care Act and how it applies to Native Americans. Mark Trahant.
There has been a lot of controversy about the Affordable Care Act, what some call Obamacare. There are the intense politics and the many computer glitches, making it nearly impossible for people to enroll. But for American Indians and Alaska Natives, the issue is another story. Native Americans have a right to health care. The United States promised to send doctors to tribes that signed treaties in exchange for peace and for titles to lands. But the entire history of health care in Indian country has been defined by shortages. A modern network, the Indian Health Service, was created in 1955, and over the following decades, clinics were built, doctors were hired, and health care for Native people improved. But still, the agency was never fully funded. There was never enough money. When Medicare and Medicaid were enacted into law in 1965, there was no consideration about how these programs would impact American Indians and Alaska Natives. The Indian Health Service could not even bill the agencies for serving eligible patients. American Indians were left out of health care reform. That history of shortages is critical context to understanding the Affordable Care Act, because from the very beginning of the legislative process, the Affordable Care Act included Indian country. So if the Affordable Care Act includes Indian country, the first question is why? Jacqueline Peta is executive director of the National Congress of American Indians.
So let me tell you why it was different this time that Indians were included in a national health bill. Because we've always, for like 19 years, have been working on trying to get the Indian health care reauthorization in place, and just really couldn't get the traction that we needed. And when the country started to talk about, once again, taking on this big project of having to have a national health care plan, we were sitting at NCAI at a board meeting, tribal leaders around the table, and we said, we really have to engage in this health debate this time around. And, you know, there were those in Indian country that said, no, you know, let's just stay where we are. We've been working our angles. We're trying to get, attach our bill to anything that we can. And we really urged them, our tribal leaders, to consider it. And Jefferson Keel, really, President Jefferson Keel, really knowing the healthcare industry probably better than many of our, you know, NCAI presidents in the past, et cetera, he agreed. And he said, yes, we should do this. And so we immediately started to look at the overall health care bill and working with the members of Congress to be able to find all those other places that it was important to insert and tribes. And so not only did we get Indian health care reauthorized permanently, but we were able to get the provisions in the Medicaid. We were able to be able to get the tax exemption. We were be able to, you know, just include a lot of places where tribes should have been considered and probably wouldn't have been if we didn't integrate those two pieces of legislation together.
So if the Affordable Care Act includes Indian country, the first question is why? American Indians and Alaska Natives have a treaty right, a statutory call to health care that transcends this latest national experiment. But recall the history of shortages. The Indian health system has never been adequately funded. Imagine this face as the Indian Health Service after receiving its annual appropriation from Congress. It's not even half full. But the Affordable Care Act opens up new funding. Money from Medicaid, money from tribal insurance, money from exchanges, new money, funds that do not have to be appropriated by Congress. Real money for Indian health.
Affordable Health Care Act is a very good thing for Indian country, a very good thing for Indian country. We have access now to more resources than ever before. And so, so this access to the resources is going to allow us to expand our services if we treat our healthcare clinics like businesses.
But to get to that much needed money, American Indians and Alaska Natives have to sign up. Sign up for Medicaid, sign up for tribal insurance, and sign up through the exchanges. This law is confusing, but it's the only way the Indian health system will get more money.
There's been so much media coverage about failed online health insurance exchanges and upbeat jingles about Cover Oregon on local TVs. Mark Trahant has more.
The headlines for the Affordable Care Act could not be worse. It's a massive failure, a technological train wreck. The whole thing is a mess, right? And worse, it's confusing as heck. So what should American Indians and Alaska Natives do? Nothing. Don't do a thing. At least not now. There are plenty of days ahead to make important decisions about what the Affordable Care Act means to your family. This is what Indian country needs to know. First, this whole enterprise, the Affordable Care Act, is about health insurance. The idea is to require every American to buy insurance because that lowers the cost for everyone else, the so-called mandate. But American Indians are exempt from that mandate. But this year at least, in order to apply for the exemption, a lifetime exemption, the application has to be filled out in person. The whole online mess does not apply. Insurance itself is a complicated idea for Indian country because what is called third-party billing has been such a small part of the Indian health system. You see, there is this odd American idea that links health insurance to our jobs. That's how most Americans now get their health care and will continue to do so, even with this new law. But that one element is a big difference for Indian country. Only 36% of American Indians and Alaska Natives have insurance purchased through work. That's half the rate for most Americans. And 30% of us have no insurance at all. The Affordable Care Act is designed to change that. The new law offers incentives for people to get health insurance coverage at a reduced rate or even free. So why would American Indians and Alaska Natives purchase insurance? Valerie Davidson is Senior Director of Legal and Intergovernmental Affairs at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium.
So if you have received your care historically from the Indian Health Service or through your tribally operated program or your urban Indian program, you're still going to be able to get health care there. The challenge we have is that the Indian health system is actually only funded at about 50% of the level of funding needed based upon the federal government's own analysis about what it costs to provide health care. And you know, anybody who's ever been to a tribally operated program or urban Indian program or an IHS facility knows that the services are limited, unfortunately, because there just isn't enough funding. So really, this is an opportunity to make sure that people also have additional health care coverage. The things that the Indian Health Service funding typically doesn't pay for is often some kind of medically necessary travel that isn't considered life or limb. So if you have an emergency, generally those are taken care of. If you need to be taken by ambulance or you need to go to the emergency room or perhaps a medevac, but it may not cover routine travel. So for example, if you live in a community where you don't have a dentist or perhaps you don't have a dental health aid therapist, then and the only oral health care that's available is in a community over that you either have to drive to or maybe fly to.
Insurance that covers medical travel is one reason to buy, and there are other reasons as well. For example, a diabetes patient who's insured would get better care, more access to the best procedures and drugs. And American Indians and Alaska Natives are allowed to buy insurance coverage through the marketplaces on a monthly basis instead of waiting for set open enrollment periods. But the problem is that the insurance marketplaces are doubly complicated for Indian country. Who's eligible? How much? And just what are the rules? The Government Accountability Office recently said that enrolling American Indians and Alaska Natives will only be successful if there is a major campaign to educate people about the expanded coverage options. That means hiring more people, lots of people, to help Native Americans navigate through this insurance maze. And that's not happening, not yet. But as Jacqueline Peta, Executive Director of the National Congress of American Indians, points out, there is already a model for that kind of campaign, last year's efforts to register Native American voters.
It's so critically important that tribes get engaged in giving direction. That tribes need to think about this as they would their Native vote campaigns. They need to be able to have sign-up fairs, so where they can actually answer the questions. Every time I go home or go anywhere, travel anywhere, this is probably the number one question I get asked these days. People are confused.
So will American Indians and Alaska Natives sign up for insurance? If that happens, it won't be because of a website in Washington, D.C. It will happen because someone in every clinic in the Indian health system explains to patients why insurance matters and how it means more money for all of us. I'm Mark Trahant reporting.
On the Warm Springs Reservation, there are people to assist with explaining insurance options and completing paper applications at the Warm Springs Health and Wellness Center in the insurance office and at the library in the Family Resource Center. Additionally, all tribal programs in Health and Human Services are working to get the message out that everyone should sign up for health insurance coverage. Audio for this segment was provided with permission from Mark Trahant and Vision Maker Media. You can access the full version online at YouTube, search Treaty or Not, or log on to Vision Maker Media. In Warm Springs, I'm Sue Matters reporting for Oregon Community Media.
Thanks so much to Sue Matters and KWSO, Pearl, Barb, and Judy from KPOV, and Wes and Jason of KSKQ in Ashland. Thanks to Dim Sums for providing the background music. Stay tuned to a radio near you for more from Oregon Community Media. We'll be working to strengthen the independent stations serving audiences from Florence to Fossil, and we'll produce another show together to air in April 2014. KBOO is proud to be among the founders of this exciting new communications resource for community broadcasters throughout Oregon. Thanks for listening.
It is 7:03. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard around the world at www.kbu.fm. Up next is Hard Knock Radio, right after these messages.
Join KBOO at the Clinton Street Theater Tuesday, February 11th, 2014 at 7 p.m. for our monthly KBOO movie night.
Manda!
Manda! To celebrate the 24th anniversary of Nelson Mandela's release from prison in South Africa, KBOO's Africa Oye will present the powerful documentary film A Mandala, A Revolution in Four-Part Harmony. Preceding the film will be a special short talk on the power of music in African society by Baba Wage Jakete, renowned artist and storyteller from Mali. That's Tuesday, February 11th at 7 p.m., Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hi, Love Jones here, DJ and producer for La Contessa de la Luna, late night host of The Confessional. I want to invite you to join her and a cast of tens to the Clinton Street Theater pre-Valentine's Day live show and extravaganza plus movie. Get ready for Thursday, February 13th when she takes over the Clinton Street Theater for a live show featuring sing-alongs, talk like Christopher Walken contest, prizes, raffles, audience confessions, and a live performance by La Contessa de la Luna, featuring the KBOO dancers. The live show is followed by the film Dogma, featuring George Carlin and Matt Damon. That's triple the entertainment for one ticket, and all proceeds benefit your community radio station, KBOO. That's La Contessa and Friends live on stage Thursday, February 13th, starting at 7 p.m. Tickets on sale now at brownpapertickets.com. Just search for KBOO. See you there.
South African youth.